When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. Mine also does chilled filtered water and chilled sparkling filtered water too. I love mine. Go to cooker.co.uk for more information. Today's Lovejoy Hour is 15 questions to Charlene Spiteri. Charlene, as you know, is lead singer of Texas. Texas have been going for 30 years. Charlene is also a great person, loves spending time in her company. Let's meet her. Here she is. Here's Charlene Spiteri. Hi, Charlene. How are you doing?
I'm very good. I'm doing head shifting because I've got a sore neck, as always.
Yeah. How is your neck? Is it sore still?
There could be so many jokes about why I've got a sore neck. But anyway, it's just I blew 3 discs in my neck 3 years ago. And it's just been, it's horrible when you get old, isn't it? And you suddenly, I hate the fact that you do things now that you have pains in your body that don't just go away after 5 minutes. Yeah. How does that happen?
Yeah, and I love exercising and I have to be careful and I hate that because I just used to do whatever I wanted to do.
I know that's stupid, but that stupid thing where you get into these conversations with like your kids or your nieces or your nephews or whatever and you go, oh yeah, no, you do it like this and then you go and do it and you go, oh God, help me up, I can't move. I'm like, I've become my mother. I've literally become that thing where I go, Mom, just relax, just do it, just move this way, or just do, and don't stiffen up. And now I'm the person that goes, oh God, stiffen up.
You know, I've always had sort of weird stuff going on in my head. And the way I used to cope with it was just by running as much as possible or exercising as much as possible. So I'd play football or run or do whatever. And I used to get so, I now know it's kind of anxiety, but I didn't at the time. And I used to get so fucked up in my head that I'd just run until I would shake. You know, like that thing, I had no energy left and I'd just keep running and running and running. Then I'd go home and collapse. And I'd be like, wake up the next day, go, all right, I'm fine now. And then one day I had to stop doing that because my body couldn't do it anymore. And it was like, oh,
you need to learn to sing. You need to just be able to just go like that. And then all that energy and all that angst and emotions and feelings just literally just goes spews out to everybody.
Is that what it is? Do you think?
Oh man, see when I'm on stage and when we're in the studio and I'm doing a vocal when I sing, not when I'm messing about like sitting going la, la, you know, like yeah. Just sing when I sing like properly. Man, my toes are literally hanging onto the floor like doosh. And it's like it surges up through your legs, right? You can feel, you pull certain bits and notes and sounds from different parts of your body and you kind of like channel this energy from certain bits of your body and then it comes out and it's like freedom. It's like...
So it's emotionally draining?
Yeah, I'll come off stage and I'll literally go... I'm like... I couldn't do Honest to God, see, if you ask me to do what I do on stage, you says to me, right, we're going to like try and get your heart rate up to here and we're going to try and make you sweat, I'd pass out. I literally would pass out. The only reason I can do it is because I'm on stage. Yeah. Well, because I'm in that moment. I'm just in that zone.
But is there, is there any way you can step on stage to sing with Texas and not do that? You have to go to that level, do you?
I can't help going to that level. I can't help it. I just can't help it because I absolutely love it. I absolutely love it. I love it. Can be so intimate and just insular, even though it's like there's thousands of people. And then there's moments where it can just literally open out and just be like the most magnificent thing ever. It just like, it's like you can see everything really clearly. You know, you literally are just like looking and going, wow. There's moments where you think you're on your own and no one else is there. The band don't even, sometimes I'm like, ugh. And then there's moments where I get literally suddenly it's just like,
it's, yeah, like, I've always thought it must be amazing when you stand on stage, the euphoria you're in and the high and the buzz. And then when you go back to normal everyday life, it must be quite a come down.
I don't even think about it. Honest to God, it's like, it's not like too different. It's not like anything like that for me. I've never thought of them as two separate things. They're just things that I do. Right. You know, I love it, but it's like, it's, I love cooking dinner. Do you know what I mean? I love walking the dog.
All right.
I know that sounds really like as if I just kind of brushing it off, but to explain to you, I'm trying to think how to explain it, because that's why I'm a bloody songwriter, because I'm so shit at explaining everything else. It's weird because I love it and I'm a bit like, yeah, I do, that's what I do, and I love to do it, and I may not do it forever, and I just need to accept that. And I'm like, but while I'm doing it, I'm going to like enjoy every frigging second of it. But I don't have to do that all the time. To me, light and shade is really important in life, because I don't think I could be a songwriter without all of those things. I need to have those moments where it's just me in the house, literally zoning out on like television going. And then I need to have those moments where I'm pushing a trolley around the supermarket and thinking, oh, what am I going to cook for dinner tonight? And then I have to go mental with my pals and have a great time, or sit and have really serious, deep conversations that are life-changing to all of us. And then I can jump on stage and literally go, woohoo, and go to my bed after it. I'm knackered. I need to go to my bed after the show. Honest to God, I'm literally like, Christ, where's my bed? I'll sleep. That's what... I am the fittest I ever am is when I'm on tour. I literally go on stage to about 11:15 at night, come off stage, sit for a bit, come down a bit, get a shower, get on the bus, maybe watch a couple of TV programs or movies or whatever, sleep, get to the hotel, go back to bed, wake up 3:30, 4:00 in the afternoon, go to the gig, sound check, one meal a day, because I can only eat one meal a day because I can't eat when I'm about to go on stage because I'm stuffed and then I kind of sing and I'm like, do you know what I mean? So I'm super fit when I go on tour. I'm like the slimmest I ever am, the fittest I ever am, the sanest I ever am, yeah.
Right, Charlene, we've got 15 questions here. We'll never get through them all. It doesn't matter. Let's just kind of go through them. It's just a way of having a conversation. So the first one's, what one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Don't just have sex with whoever you... just don't do it. My mum said to me when I was about 12, she said, listen, you're going to have sex with whoever you're going to have sex with. She's, but listen, when you do it, just make sure they know exactly what they're getting. Like, literally make sure that you know that they just think it is the best thing on the planet. Swear to God, literally stopped me having sex with so many people. It was brilliant, because I would think... you could think, oh, I quite fancy him, or oh, I'm kind of feeling that. And then you kind of go, is he going to think that was like the best thing ever? Nah, maybe not. He's not smart enough to appreciate it, but move on. stopped me so many times.
I decided to have a birds and bee conversation with my daughters. They hated it. And
I would have loved to hear that.
It was like, look, I don't care what you do, as long as it's your choice. That was it. And that was all I said to them. It's like if you're going to have sex with someone, as long as it's your choice, it doesn't matter. If you're going to do drugs, as long as it's your choice, someone else is not making you do it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But I had one with Misty. My birds and the bees conversation with Misty was Mickey Flanagan's sketch.
Which one?
Literally the one where he said, he talks about that moment where he talks about fingering.
You had that conversation with her?
Yeah, and she literally was like that, like the horror on my daughter's face. And I went, and the thing is that woman, he saw her, she was a big, she was like a big massive executive, and he literally was like, and she was growing about her penthouse flat, and he walked away and he just went, still fingered you. I went, that sums it up. I went, that sums it up, Misty. Just remember. And that was my Misty says, I can't believe that your birds and the bees. Now she's nearly 19. And she said to me, I can't believe that I still to this day don't believe that your birds and bees talk to me was a Mickey Flanagan sketch. But I thank Mickey Flanagan because I think that this is the most horrific thing, because even when you watch the sketch on his show, every woman in the audience, when he says it, goes, oh.
Yeah,
and for me that said everything, because there wasn't a single woman that's ever seen that never just went, oh, that was it. So that's how you hit them.
Thing is about giving advice to kids is I always thought is my, they don't want to do it. I never did what my parents told me to do. So it's like kind of they're gonna make their own decisions, aren't they? Once they hit,
that's you.
15, 16. You say that.
It's not me. I did everything my parents asked me to do. That's why my sister still to this day calls me Goody Two Shoes.
Really?
She really does.
Okay, right. Next question. What's the best moment of your career?
Best moment of our career. Oh God, there's been so many. The fact that we're still bloody here.
Yeah, how do you keep a band together?
The fact that we're still here. Sheer determination. I don't know. Being able to ride the ups and downs. You got to be able to ride the downs as well as the ups. If not, you'll never be around.
What's interesting about Texas, though, is am I correct in this? You kind of made it. Right at the beginning, had a bit of success. Then it sort of went away for a while before it came.
Well, it went away. It went away in the UK. That was the thing, is that the UK we couldn't get arrested. I mean, seriously, we were like the shit on people's shoes. We put our first record out in '89. Why Do What I Love Her? Massive record, had loads of success, and but we sold a lot of records worldwide. So what happened was basically that. The sort of whole Manchester scene and everything happened and all that was coming through, and we just weren't part of it with nothing. It was like, you know, we just weren't that sound or anything, and so UK we weren't selling any records, and lucky enough we sold bucket loads of records everywhere else, so that allowed us to keep a record contract, and then we just went away. We made White on Blonde and Say What You Want came out, and literally it was really funny. I remember when Say What You Want came out, most of our record company never even knew that we were on their label. That's the God's honest truth. They were a bit like, what the hell, what, they're ours? That was a bit like that.
And that song just hit, didn't it, massively. I remember Chris Evans, he just kept playing it.
He had the best thing about Chris was that Chris played it, and apparently, well, he did say this, but apparently it wasn't stocked in some record shops at the time when we still had record shops. And Chris Evans made a comment on the radio and said, you'd think that you'd be able to get hold of the record, something, blah, blah, blah. And John Kennedy, who was the head lawyer of Polygram and Phonogram, Universal Records at that point, and he literally heard it, and he's driving in the office and literally hit the roof. And went, what do you mean nobody can get this frigging record? And they restocked every shop, and literally that's how it happened.
Yeah, because he was a big fan of it. So what was it like then? So you had a big single, and then it sort of went away. And then when he comes back that much bigger, is it just an amazing feeling then? Does it become just even more exciting?
It's an amazing feeling to get another shot at it.
Yeah,
it really is, and that's what it was. It was like, oh, okay, right. Well, what did we do that? Right, this is a new time, a new era. How do we do things? Like, take advantage of every opportunity that we're going to get, and absolutely stick to our guns on what we believe in. And that was literally what we did. I mean, it was stupid things like, I mean, you know, things like we did the single as well with the Wu-Tang Clan. I know we spoke about this, but it was so funny because I remember going to the Brits, and they were, you know, the Brits were always doing the big collabs and making these amazing, like, people. Like, I remember when Jamiroquai did it with Diana Ross and everything. I remember I'd just come back from New York making Say What You Want with the Wu-Tang, and I get called into the Brits, and they were like, right, we want you to do a duet, and we're thinking that, you know, it'd be great if you sung with Smokey Robinson. And I remember thinking, I don't believe these words are going to come out of my mouth. And I went, yeah, maybe not. and you know, I would cut my right arm off to sing with Smokey Robinson. I mean, seriously, it's like, I probably wouldn't have wrote half the songs we've written if I hadn't been for Smokey Robinson. And then I thought, I'm going to say this. And I just went, nah. And they were like, sorry. And I was like, we've just made a record with the Wu-Tang Clan, and it would be really cool, because what was in my head was, that's what everyone's going to expect us to do, is, oh, it's going to be the combination. They did the Al Green cover. They did say, you know, it's going to be the soul thing. And I thought, it's just typical, and it's safe, and it's boring. So let's completely throw something out there. And I remember I was just like, we can get you the Wu-Tang. And they were like, what? And that was how we ended up with Method Man playing the Brits with us.
Had many people done that back then? Stuck sort of...
No, and it's funny because we've made a documentary. It's not come out yet. But it's RZA and I having the big... We did a documentary about the making of Say What You Want. And RZA and I are sitting having this conversation. It's really funny because RZA says to me, I mean, you guys took such a big chance doing that. And I literally go... What? I was like, can you on the smoke again? What's going on? I was like, no. I says, you guys took a big chance making that record. And he says, yeah, but no one had done it before. And I was like, and it was weird to hear him say it. Do you know what I mean? It was weird just hearing him saying no one had done it. And I was like, no, actually, no one had done that before.
It's funny because you hear that sort of thing so often now, don't you?
Exactly.
But at the time, it must have been quite unusual.
Yeah. I mean, there was people, people like Doug Morris and everybody were like in the, like sitting in the audience going, whoa, 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 who are, like, and they're like, yeah, they're signed to Universal.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it was great because we've kind of always been on the outside, even though we've had such a long, long career.
All right, next question then on that. What is the, what does success mean to you?
Having a good sleep at night, not thinking how the hell to play the bills.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. That is what it is. Success is doing the dream, the job. I mean, I say the job, but this is what I dreamt of doing. I was doing it for nothing when I started. Like, we all were when we start out. You're not doing it. It's never about the money. And still to this day, all the decisions are made not on a check. It's like, is this right for us? Is this right for the band? Does this work for us? Does this protect everything? And, you know, and that's how we make all the decisions. And that's enabled us to have to go to bed at night and think, don't want to take a year off. You know,
has the industry changed a lot in the way you think about things? Because obviously years ago, it was like, I need to get as high up the charts as possible. The charts don't seem to have as much influence, do they, anymore?
You need to be on playlists at radio, you need to get the TV shows, you still got to get, I mean, there's so much. The problem is that there's not a lot of TV shows that have music on them anymore. And what you try to do is you've got to get on to the shows so that people know you've got a record out and think, oh, they're back again. Oh, they've got a record and talk about it. And, you know, so you're trying to spread across as many different audience, basically record buyers, as you possibly can to make them aware, because you don't have things like Top of the Pops or the charts or whatever that people listen to. It's not the way it used to be. It's very, very different. You're trying to go on to, you know, like loads of playlists on streaming. It is very, very different. But trust me, there's a load of work that you really need to do to make a record happen.
So the band's lucky they have you then as the front person.
I don't know if they would say that.
Well, you do all the work because you're the one who comes on the TV show.
That's just because I'm a control freak. I'm like, that's shut up. That's not what we think. That's not who we are. You know what I mean?
But the other thing is, it's like, you know, Sunday brunch, everyone, all the bands are desperate to get on Sunday brunch because we're the only show with music on it anymore, you know?
Exactly.
And so, you know, when your name comes up, everyone just goes, yeah, immediately, don't they? Because it's like, oh, Charlene, she's great. She'll be great. And, you know, everything's good.
No, they
know
because that's because they know I'm always going to drink the goddamn drinks. My mate calls me up when I was on the show then. She goes like to me, how drunk were you the other day? I was like, that, I swear to God, I had to have a lie down when I get back to the house. I was like, those bloody rum punch thing. I was like, the thing is I always make the big mistake because it's typical me. I go, I don't kind of go, you know, like that advert when you see Mariah Carey and Kim Walker's crisps. And she goes like that. She goes, like, who the fuck eats a crisp like that? Who in their right mind eats a crisp? We're like, let me just, I don't even think she licked it. I think she kind of goes, touches her lips. I'd have been like that. In one big bite. And that's what I did on Sunday brunch. I just went like, whoa. And I swear to God, I was literally quite like, woo-hoo.
I always see the good thing about Sunday brunch is we started something for the weekend. I think you might have come on it years ago.
I was.
Yeah. And I've always, when we first got in the show, it was a load of people with clipboards going, do this, do that. And I was like, oh, I just come from Soccer AM, obviously, which I've done. And I was like, oh, it's just got to be fun. The more fun we have, the more fun the guests will have, the more fun the viewers will have. And I think Sunday brunch is such a, like, people love coming on it because you just sit and have a laugh for 3 hours and drink and eat.
Exactly. And it was that point where you were bringing Soccer AM to, you know, that kind of ethos to something like this. Because the thing is, I used to lie in my bed and watch Soccer AM and just laugh my pants off. Do you know what I mean? Talking about David Furniture and his you know,
how do you remember that?
Oh, he's a lovely tall boy. Oh, I have to polish the knobs on that. I used to sit and literally absolutely deck myself laughing because it was just brilliant. It was absolutely brilliant. And then doing all the dancing and shit, and, you know, like just doing the, like, all the Arsenal guys and everything. You know, it was just brilliant. It was just like really clever ideas and really, really funny and just that slight chaos. Yeah. I love it.
The thing I miss most about Soccer AM is, he's sitting with you got yourself a brew. That's great.
Bryn just walked in. He came right around a big giant circle and just brought me a cup of tea.
That's great. That's fantastic. Yeah, the thing I miss about not doing Soccer AM at the moment is the sketches. We just used to take the mickey out of things. At the moment, I don't know if you've noticed on TV, nothing against these programs, by the way, I like them, but every single program is, let's guess something. So it's like, let's guess who's in the mask. Let's guess whose home it is. Let's guess who can sing and who can't sing. And I'd do something like, let's guess whose shoes these are or something.
Because you know why? You're not allowed to, that's because you're not allowed to take the piss out of anybody anymore. You're not allowed to say jack shit about anything. You're literally like, oh, can't say that. You're like, what do you mean? You couldn't possibly say, oh, what a lovely tall boy. Now, you can't, you would just somebody be like, you're not allowed to say that. It'd be somebody with a clipboard going, nope, lose that sketch, lose. So it's really hard. You can't do the sketches anymore. I mean, seriously, those get, it's like, honest to God, see the one, the Masked Singer. I never got one single one right. I was literally going, and then when anybody came out of them, I was terrible because I was literally, you did that? I was like, fucking hell. I was like, but you're a singer. That was what was really shocking. I was like going, whoa.
I don't hate those shows, but once someone gets a show, that's it. It's like the Great British something. Yeah, the Great British.
I don't hate them.
No.
But I just can't guess them. I am watching them.
I was the Great British Bake Off, then the Great British Pottery Throwdown, British Jewelry.
You can't say anything but the Pottery Throwdown. That was my literally. I lived for that over.
They're all great. I mean, they're all great, but it's funny. Someone finds a theme, and then TV makers just go, "Mate, as
I'm going, as I'm going on a pottery course. I'm going to learn to throw pots because I did what possibly half the British public did was I started like I was online. Ooh, I'll buy some clay. Then I saw how much an oven was, and I went, "What the."
Really?
So I was like making wee fires outside, and I was doing like raga style oven. I was like throwing, I've got right into it. So now I'm going to go. I'm definitely going on a pottery course. That's why I'm dressed in my dungarees today. No, I'm going to go and do a pottery course and learn how to throw pots.
That's good. Yeah, it's great. It's good for the mind. Right, next question. We're never going to get through any of these. Let's try another one. What other jobs did you do? Well, it's famous. You were a hairdresser. Did you enjoy doing that?
Loved being a hairdresser. Oh, I used to have the best playlists on the planet because I would make up the tapes in the salon. I'd be like, salon mixtape. Loved it. It was great. You know, I just thought it was brilliant. It was like, it was the 80s. We had Catherine Hamlet uniforms when I was a junior. I was a fully qualified hairdresser by the end. I'd only been a hairdresser a year when I joined Texas. And then it was another year because I was 18 when I was the week before my 18th birthday when I met Johnny. So for a full year, we were writing and trying to get a record deal. But I loved it. I used to travel with him. I went to New York, Italy, everything with him and doing shows. And honest to God, it was fully glamorous. It was great fun. The stuff people tell you when you're doing their hair is insane.
They trust you, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you'd literally, someone sits down in front of you. How many people do you see with their hair all wet? And then you're going to run your fingers through their hair. I mean, it doesn't really get any more personal. You're kind of like, Here we go. You're a bit like, right, I'm going to change how you look. You're going to tell me, you're going to give me an idea of how you want to look. And I'm going to like do your hair. But I used to have this trick that this friend of mine who's no longer with us, Robert Morrison, who trained me. He taught me, he was an amazing hairdresser. And he always used to say, when someone comes to you with a photograph, literally put your thumb over the face and say, is that the haircut you want? Just hide the face and say to them, is that the haircut? But this guy used to come in all the time. Oh, it was genius. And he always had a photograph of, do you remember that actor Michael Praed Robin of Sherwood or something. Right,
okay.
Right. I mean, the only reason I remember it is because this guy showed me this photograph and he just basically had long hair and a fringe, but then Michael Praed got a perm. It was the most genius moment of ever in my career because he was literally like, he's had a perm, and I was like, mate, do you seriously want to get a perm? Really? Yeah. Finger over the face, and he went, oh yeah, maybe not. I was like, I saved you. So yeah, I love being a hairdresser. It was great fun.
Do you remember the conversation you had where you said, I gotta leave the job because I'm off to be a rock star, a pop star?
Yeah. So. My boss said to me, don't worry, your job's here for you if it doesn't work out.
Still,
but honestly, my boss Rita Rusk, she's like, she's still a friend of mine because her sister is one of my best mates. I still see all the girls from the salon and everything, girls and the guys. They'll come to Texas concerts and they're like,
that's brilliant.
It's great fun.
All right. So what is your outstanding fashion moment? Could be good or bad. Have you had one? Have you had a regret?
A regret? I've had hundreds of regrets. There was one major regret I had. It was like in 1989 and I was doing promo in Universal Records, and I thought I'll have a Sade moment, and I wore a white shirt and big hoop earrings. Fucking hell. There's still photograph. Honest to God, I look like a hooker. I literally, I don't suit anything. I can't put any jewellery near me. I literally, I look like a bloke.
What do you like wearing on stage? Is it about comfort? If you,
yeah,
yeah.
For me, I've got to be able. First thing I do when I'm like deciding what I wear on stage, I go like that because I need to be able to play my guitar. If I can't play, if I can't move my guitar.
By the way, this is audio. Charlene's putting her elbow up.
Oh, sorry, folks. Sorry, my elbow just went right up to my ear there. I have to be able to pull my arm back and pull my shoulders right back. You know, you don't want to be trying to take a guitar off and you're literally like, try to squeeze through it because you get some tiny little jacket on. I like comfort. I like to be able to run because I run up and down stage a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I run around like a nutter on stage. Can't help myself.
Did you ever have the conversation as a band of like how we're going to dress, what we're going to wear, what's our image? Did you ever do that?
Absolutely. You look at the first Texas stuff in 89 and it was literally like biker jacket, biker boots, pair of 501s. That's it. You know, and everything was salvaged. You know, we'd be all salvaged. It'd be like everything. We were like really particular. Lee Storm Rider jackets, everything, the lot. It had to be a short leather jacket. We were all obsessed at that point about what we were wearing. And for me, I am literally going to dress like a boy. That was it. I was like, I'm dressing like a boy.
Hmm.
I remember getting called all sorts by record companies. Oh, what's a lesbian doing this week? I just thought, what's the wanker doing this week? You know what I mean?
Is it cool for the band though to know that, because all the videos they basically feature you, don't they? I mean, is it cool for them that they can go right, push Charlene to the front, there you go, she can do all the hard work here, Tim, in this photo shoot.
I know you do TV, but have you ever made a video?
No.
It's the most boring thing on the face of the planet.
Yeah, I know,
I never had to make another video ever in my life again, I would be the happiest person on the planet. Literally, my band, my band literally go, oh God, do we need to be in it? I mean, oh God, do we need to do this?
Yeah.
They don't want, they have no interest in doing it.
Yeah, but that's
it.
What I mean. It must be great for them. They can just go, oh, you know, you can go and do it all.
Yeah. But then I like bitch at them. I just go like that. You don't even know I'm doing all this stuff. I don't want to do it. You know.
Well, I do you know what? Interesting, I hate doing pre-recorded TV. Because you always do that stuff where you always got a cameraman or a sound man or something, and they go, one more for me. And you're like, oh, go fuck yourself. I've just
performed. Oh, I do say go fuck yourself. I'm terrible. I have a terrible thing. I have such a bad attitude. You know, when somebody does like you do things and they go like that, yeah, kind of just like, you know, maybe just tilt your head a bit more or just, and the other one is when it's a pre-record as well, because they obviously do, drop the mic down and you're like, I'm fucking singing live. You knob.
Yeah.
I'm going to be like the most hated person on the planet, aren't I? Because I've literally went like that. I've given all the secrets away.
On live TV, they can't get you to do another one. Which
on live TV, you just like, you're alone to yourself. On live TV, you're like, literally, they can't edit you. So if you've been a little bit cheeky because somebody said something to you and they've been a bit like taking the piss, live TV, you can literally just go boom right straight back at them and no one can edit it.
Exactly.
So you don't look like a loser. It's like, yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by Mainbrace, which is a premium golden rum. Run by a family based in Cornwall and sourced in the Caribbean. Its name is a nod to the naval tradition of splicing the Mainbrace, which was a tough ask on a ship and was rewarded with rum when completed. However, it's now come to mean a toast to victory. It's a very smooth drink that is delicious on its own, simply paired with tonic or ginger ale and also in rum-based cocktails. It's just won a gold at the Rum Masters and has a unique flavour thanks to it being a blend of two styles of rum, one from Guyana and one from Martinique, two styles which have never been bottled together before. If you go to mainbracerum.com, use the promotional code CheersTim when you buy a bottle of Mainbrace Premium Golden Rum or Mainbrace Navy Strength Rum, you get a free case of Fevertree Tonic Water. So use the promo code CheersTim. This promotion is available until May the 31st. Back to the podcast, sponsored by Mainbrace Premium Golden Rum. I did this thing once where I worked in a car show for a year. I wasn't great. I was bought on it, not because I know about cars. I didn't know about cars. That was the angle. Anyway, they ragged me around the racing track and I came out and I was terrified. And I got out of the car at the end. And I was like, oh, shit, like that. And the reaction of me, because I honestly was terrified. And I came out at the end and then I was like, oh, my God, got out of the car, stumbled out, an absolute shock. And then about 30 seconds later, the cameraman went, can you do that one more time for me? I was like, no, I'm not an actor. Fuck off.
Exactly. That's what I say is like whenever, like I'll say, I'm not an actor. Or you go and do it for, I'm not a model. I'm not going to do it. Jason Plato ran me around one of the tracks at Carfest, because you go around, you have to do that thing. Oh my God. I literally got out of his car and vomited. I puked my guts up. I went, that is the most disgusting, horrible experience I've ever had in my life. That was, and they're all laughing at me. I was like, you lot are a bunch of wankers.
You have to act to do a video though, don't you? Have you done much acting? I mean, I haven't seen you in much. Have you done much?
It's funny because it's like, you know, it's like anything. You get in a band, you do a few videos, then the calls start coming. People are like, do you want to be in this movie? Do you want to do this? Can you do that? And I've always said no, and I'm like, I'm not an actress. And they go, because I have such a respect for actors, because I love cinema more than anything. I love movies. And it's such an art. If somebody needs me to be me, and they go like, yeah, but I've seen you doing videos. And I'm like, yeah, but that's me being me.
Right.
I'm me in that, you know. It's like, but I've done videos with some of the best actors in the world. You know, Alan Rickman, Jean Reno. You know, yeah. we did the High video, and it's you know, for that I love, because I was in the boot of a car, you know. They say, Fen, who's the video director, she's like, how do you feel about getting into the boot of a car? And I was like, hell yeah. I love it when anybody asks me to do something mad. Von Arnell wanted me to be Elvis, and I was like, oh, yeah, can I be Elvis? And, you know, they went and cast my head. We went down to Shepperton and they did all my head cast and everything. And I became Elvis. And the thing is I became Elvis because I thought I was Elvis when I was four. You know, I used to literally, like, put loads of shampoo in my hair and literally, like, in the bath and flick my hair up into a quiff and go, you know, I thought I was Elvis. So literally for me to be Elvis and, like, do all the guitar stuff and everything and the moves, I was like, I know that because it's embedded into my soul, because mm-hmm. I thought I was Elvis. You know, I thought I was Joe Strummer. I was like, I'm just, you know, the truth is I'm just basically a dreamer, and that is it. I was always a dreamer. I was told I was a dreamer at school, and every report card it said to my mom that I was a nutter, and that is it. And yeah, so all those things, it's about kind of, I see things in 3D, and I literally, when someone asks me to do something or be something, I can literally kind of almost like go and step into it quite so easily.
Why wouldn't you want to do acting?
I nearly did a movie, a French movie, many, many years ago. But then what happened was, as we were about to make it, and what was really good fun about it is I had to learn to rollerblade for this movie, and I had the French world champion teach me how to rollerblade. I'm so good. You should see, I can do crisscross. Mate, seriously, you should see me in a set of rollerblades. Woohoo! But as we were about to start filming, and it was a really dark movie, and yeah, it was French, so I thought I had that headspace where I thought, it's a French movie. If it does well, it's going to be like pure cult, but if it doesn't do anything, it'll disappear because it's a French movie. So that was where my head was. I was thinking, it's kind of like a safe level for me to go in at. So, you know, and then there was a massive strike, and then I got pregnant and we never made it because there was a strike for like for about a year or something. It was a nutty one where there was like everyone was up in arms, and then the movie got put back because they lost the funding, and it was about a year, and then I got pregnant and had Misty.
Twice I had a go acting, and both times not only was I appalling, I just didn't enjoy it. I just thought this is really dull.
But what did you have to do?
I kind of once I had to be myself and once I had to pretend to be. So I was only like a tiny little scene, and one was in a movie and one was in a TV show. And both times I just thought, this is just not good.
It's because you're not controlling it.
Maybe it's someone else's words as well. And I was thinking,
exactly. Because that's the thing is, when people say to me, yeah, but you've done videos, and I say, yeah, but that's our songs and that's my interpretation. Yeah. You know, that's why I have such respect for actors, is because you've got to just be able to move on.
Yeah.
Because you could be with the best director, the best actors on the planet. You know, I've seen actors that literally I think are some of the best actors on the planet, and then I've seen them in a movie and I've went, whoa, that's bad. Mm-hmm. So it's a really difficult, because depending on edits, depending on how something's, you know, cut, put together, how much money they're going to pump into everything, it's you just don't know what you're going to get. And maybe I'm just too scared.
I did an advert once. I'm laughing because I know what's coming. It got voted the worst advert of the year.
What advert?
It was pasta. And in my defense...
You did a pasta advert?
Yeah. And in my defense, the director walked out halfway through it. It was only one day shooting. Halfway through it, when I'm not doing it anymore, he walked out because he went, "You're making him look stupid." Because this is you've hired Tim because he's known in England, and he's like in Britain, and he's known as this kind of whatever he wanted to describe me as. And he said, "You're making him into an arsehole," and then he just walked out, and it was so funny on the shoot. I phoned my agent up, and I went, "The director's just left. What shall I do?"
Should I stay? I'm literally going, who's sat in some, like, you know, meeting and went, "Pasta, Tim Lovejoy." I mean, the most genius story I ever heard, Brian Ferry told me, which in fact Brian Ferry's then wife told me, and Brian was there. And it was literally like, he's been offered this advert, and he'll not let them use the music. And I was literally like, "Oh, what is it? And basically someone wanted to use Avalon for the Savalon advert. It's the best story. Could you imagine? Savalon.
That's brilliant.
And I was like, "I'm sorry, Brian, but I think I would have let them use it just because whoever thought that up is a genius." Do you know what I mean? That's like, that is great. That is just, it's a great story. And I was literally like, so I always wondered about the advertising people that literally go, "Tim Lovejoy, pasta, yeah. I can see how that can work.
Right, next question, because you just alluded to it a minute ago, is what were you like at school? You mentioned, first of all, about Joe Strummer, and so you were clearly into the Clash and stuff, but you mentioned your mum as well. What were you like in your school reports?
Well, I was really badly bullied at school. I was a complete dork. I was a geek. I was just not... I was this wee scrawny little kid with a name like Charlene Spiteri growing up in Glasgow. It was literally like, let's just pile a whole load more on here, you know. And my parents moved from Glasgow out to Loch Lomond, and when I went to this school, so I would have been in primary six, just going out primary seven when we moved, and then went on to secondary school. Oh God, I was in my own planet. All I cared about was, you know, getting a record, buying my record, a single on a Saturday, and getting a little plastic cover that you could slip the vinyl into. And the thing was, is I wasn't any boys. I was kind of like, all the girls would go to the record shop because they would be like, "Oh my God, he's cute and this one's cute and all the rest of it." And I would be like, whoa, head in, looking at records, or playing, because the record shop that we used to go to in Alexandria had an arcade off it. You used to play Defender and Pac-Man and all that.
Defender.
And Centipede. I used to love Defender, picking up all those It was brilliant, wasn't it? Fantastic. And then and Centipede as well. I loved Centipede because it had the roly sort of the control to it. You would just roll it around. So yeah, and then the centipede would get broke up into bits, and you'd be like, "Whoa, the centipede's everywhere!" So yeah, like I just loved that. So I was always a real tomboy growing up, and it just didn't work. It just didn't work at school, you know. And I was a bit like, I think people thought I was really aloof, but because I was really quiet, and I know that's hard to believe. I was so quiet. I honestly, I was really quiet. But I think it was quiet because I was just a bit like, who are these? What am I doing here? I literally was in going, why am I at school? I hated school. Like, hated it. Like, there was not a bit of school that I enjoyed. My school asked me to come back a long time ago. I went, you can fuck right off, was my answer. I was like, the worst years of my life, and you want me to revisit it? I don't think so.
What were you listening to then? Because you said Strummer a minute ago. Were you listening to The Clash? And were you listening?
I love The Clash. Yeah, I love The Clash. Clash, Echo and the Bunny Men, Dexys, Blondie, Pretenders, Patti Smith. Oh God, all sorts. And then all the stuff from my parents, that Lee Hazelwood and Nancy Sinatra, and my mum was really into like rhythm blues and soul and jazz. So like Ella Fitzgerald, Mahalia Jackson, Al Green, Marvin Gaye, of course. Like I can't function without Marvin Gaye, Diana Ross, all that kind of stuff. And my dad was into like the Beatles and the Stones, the Byrds, Creedence. You know, my dad worked in America. He was a captain in the Merchant Navy. So my dad worked in America, so loads of American music, a lot of American music would come back to us, like Love and everything, like all those bands. A lot of that sort of whole Californian thing was part of my dad's collection. I remember when my dad bought Rumours Fleetwood Mac, literally being like, whoa, this is amazing. But my dad would buy records, like he would do, so my dad would do 3 months on at sea and then a month off. And when he would come home for that month, he would have always like his cash and stuff like this. And he would just go out and he'd be like, he'd spoil us all. And he'd buy literally shitloads of records. And we would just like go through all that, all the vinyl, which I still have to this day.
So amazing eclectic mix there, which is
massive.
Yeah.
There was nothing that, you know, you wouldn't go. I mean, literally, there would be Barry Manilow in the record collection as well. And people would kind of go, ooh, you know, but no, it's great, great songs, well written, ABBA, everything you could imagine was in there.
I think it's really tough for bands or artists starting out right at this minute. But I was coming, I've said this a few times on the podcast, I've bored my listeners with it before, but I come downstairs when the twins are here, as you know, my twins are 19, similar age as Misty, but they come down and they're listening to sort of the Smiths, followed by Kate Bush, followed by the Beatles. Yeah. It's like how do you, because it's all streaming and they've got Spotify, they're getting fed all this stuff and they love it. Or how on earth, if you're a new band, you compete against the Rolling Stones and Beatles and you know, and the Smiths and whoever else? It's kind of,
well, the thing is I've kind of gone on and on about this a lot recently, because I was just saying, look, we've really got to look after the young artists that are making albums, because yeah, you can listen to the Stones and Kate Bush and even, you know, and the Beatles and all that stuff, because those bands, we knew they, like people knew the albums and they bought the albums. So what would happen is, the reason that they can be streamed so much is because they would have 5 or 6 songs come off one record that were singles. Mm. Whereas you get these young bands that they're lucky if they get 2 songs off one album. So it's like, well, that, you know, if you don't build up catalog is the most important thing you can have. If these young bands don't get the chance to build up catalog, they can't go on tour. Because people will just be like, well, I only know one song, I don't know anything about them, I'm not going to pay for a ticket because they don't have any other records. It's like, well, you know, when you buy an album, I just see the same stuff all the time. It's like, nobody loves track five. Nobody loves track seven. Nobody fucking loves them. 3 weeks in, suddenly somebody's going, oh my God, track five. Yeah. Like, if that wasn't on the album, the album would not come together. Yes. So you've got to give it that opportunity and that chance to grow, to become yours, to become your record. And that's what makes bands and that's what makes albums. And the really stupid thing is that record companies, if they don't build catalog, they are fucked.
Mm.
So they need to build new catalog because the old catalog's not going to keep them going forever.
Mm.
So yeah, they need to build a new catalog.
Yeah, it's a really interesting time for music at the moment. Obviously, music will never die because, you know, people love it and that's it. But being a new artist, I suppose they need to. It's got to be in the lyrics and what they're saying. Most artists who come on my show at the moment, the younger ones, they're talking about mental health. All their lyrics are about trying to survive mental health. It seems to be the big thing at the moment.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of like a way of saying, you know, as a songwriter, I mean, you could argue that as a songwriter, yeah, you are dealing with all those issues because, you know, I know that when, you know, I was being really badly bullied or when certain things were happening in my life, my only way of ever not dealing with them, but I guess probably maybe letting them go was to write a song. And you put, you know, lyrics and what you say in a song are only yours at the moment that you write it. And then as soon as you release that record, it becomes everybody else's because we listen to music and we put our own faces in our own situations and I do other people's records. So we are dealing with deep, deep emotions and questions because when you're young there's so many questions. You know, I still have loads of questions as a 53-year-old woman, but the amount of questions that we have that we don't know the answers to, that we've not got the life experiences to enable us to kind of cope with them, is hard. And as a young person nowadays with social media piled on top of that, I think, fuck, how do you cope with the pressure of stuff being rammed down your throat constantly? And then there's people on social media that should not have any voices, that are just fucking bullies and horrible human beings that just take complete pleasure and joy in fucking other people's lives up. And they shouldn't, you know, it's like you've got to be really, really careful. And when young people look at social media, they have got to look at it. Don't take it literal. I'm literally just like,
whatever. Yeah, but I think the fundamental problem with it, and the next question is, what's your relationship like with social media? But the fundamental problem with social media is the bosses of all the media companies are taking it seriously. I can't tell you how often I get interviewed and they interview me about my bloody social media posts. And it's like, God, there's other things going on. They either do Wikipedia or social media posts. But when the newspapers are printing constantly what's happening on social media, or if I said something on social media, my bosses would sack me because of something I said. That is the issue with it, is that people are taking it too seriously.
And that's it. And that's why you've got to be real, because it's a massive weight to put on people, certain people that maybe can't take that weight.
Yeah.
That's what we've got to remember is that, you know, you kind of think, well, I'm going to look, maybe I'm going to get on social media. You don't know if you're going to be able to cope with social media. And there's people out there, as we know, look at Caroline Flack and people, they can't cope with social media. It's literally, they're not cut out to do it. You know, for me, it's like press. I don't look at the good press and I don't look at the bad press. So I'm not just going to be delude myself with looking at all the great stuff and think, oh, I'm fucking amazing. So if I'm not going to read the bad stuff, I'm not going to read the good stuff.
My relationship with this changed a lot recently. I was going to tweet all about the ESL, the European Super League, the other day, and I just thought, I can't be asked, because I can't be asked with the shit which will come with
but
it.
But that is age. That's what happens with age, is you have that knowledge of, oh, I know what all the baggage that's going to come with. Come, you know,
can't be bothered.
So you go, do you know, do I need that shit in my life? Do I need that pressure? Nah, forget it. Pleh, load of crap. Do you know what I mean? So you do that. Yeah. And saying that, it works in other ways. It's amazing. I came on the show the other week.
Yeah.
I got a lovely letter from Mr. Tunnock and a giant box of Tunnock's wafers.
I did. Oh, that's fantastic.
So do you know what I mean? It's like there's fun things, but I don't, for me, I just do it.
I keep saying to the producers, we need to warn people who come on our show, because when artists come on our show, sometimes what happens is they just come and they have a laugh. There's always an asshole or two who will have a pop at them. And sometimes people aren't used to it because they're just artists who've only got fans. And suddenly they open themselves up to, yeah, my show's got quite a lot of reach of different people.
Yeah.
So they go, well, we don't like you. And it's, you know, not everyone's supposed to like you, but I don't think everyone realizes that. So.
I think it's again, with age comes that you realize that not everybody likes you. And with age comes, I don't really give a shit if they don't like me. You know, we go through this, our youth thinking I'm a rebel, I'm strong, I'm a punk, I'll fuck everybody. Yeah. And we're not. Now I'm like, literally, fuck everybody. Do you know what I mean? I'm like, but I thought I was that when I was young, and I wasn't that. Yeah, I was literally going, oh, who am I? What am I? I want them to like me. Mm. I don't care if they don't like me, but I want those ones to like me. And then what happens when those ones don't like, you know, it's a really, really, really difficult journey. Growing up is a difficult journey. And you know what? It's not going to be plain sailing.
Yeah.
And it is tough. And it's tough when you put yourself out there. And that's the big thing, is like, if you're going to put yourself out there, be prepared. Really be prepared. And that's what people need to be aware of, is that you need to be ready for not everybody to like you, or for people to be really just downright fucking horrible to you. Yeah.
You're guaranteed the bigger you get, the more people you have who don't like
you. Oh, the bigger you get, they really don't like you.
Yeah, you should judge your success on how many people don't.
I remember somebody said that my voice was more numbing than Novocaine. And the best laugh is that I remember thinking, you motherfucker. I literally wanted to go around and like visit the journalist. Do you remember back in the days when bands used to like kidnap journalists and like tie them up and do all sorts to them? Can't do that now, you go to jail. Do you know what I mean?
All right, just a couple more questions. Have you ever seen a ghost or a UFO?
Seen a ghost. There's a ghost in my kitchen in the house in London where you've been, and literally sits at the end of the table. It's a woman and a small boy. Really? And it's really weird. I'm not the only person that's seen it. My mum saw it the first time she walked in the house. She went, you know, there's a woman sitting at the end of your table. And I went, I know, she's there. Some days she's there, some days she's not. And there's about five people have walked in my house and went, look that.
Yeah. Double take.
Yeah. There used to be a room, a small room, and we knocked the wall down, and that small room became part of the kitchen, and there's a big long table there. And this woman sits at the end of the table. And I always just go, I haven't seen her for a long time, mind you. But I always just go, all right. I always say hello. My mum always told me to be nice to spirits. So I'm going to be nice to spirits, because my mother said it. I told you, I always do what my mum told me.
Do what your mum tells you. It doesn't scare you at all to have one in there?
No, because it's a nice one. It's not a shitty one. I used to have one that when my uncle died years ago, I would have been about six or something.
Yeah.
And I was really close to my uncle. He was an amazing painter. He was an artist. And he was killed in a swimming accident. And for a year after my uncle was killed, I used to come out off my bunk beds and literally come down. We had a big long hall in our house in Glasgow. We lived in a tenement. So I lived in a, we lived in a tenement, and it had a big long hall. And the toilet was at the end. And whenever I got up, I used to come belting back down and going, oh, fucking, and my mum be like, what is it? they took me to see a psychiatrist and everything as a kid, because then I started wetting the bed as well. I was literally a nightmare as a child. But I kept seeing, like, some days it would be a really nice man and he was all white and glowy and looked lovely and he would stand and talk to me. My mum would come out to the hall and I'd be sitting having a conversation with somebody. Hold on 2 seconds. Sorry, everybody. This is my next interview.
The final question is, what is the meaning of life?
Still trying to work that out. Still trying to work it out, but Jesus Christ, I love it. I love life. You know, I really, really like life. I really enjoy life. I like the people that I've met through my life and that have become friends. They make me laugh. They basically lock my brain into thoughts and ideas. And I love just that whole thing of like sitting down and cooking and having all my friends come round and literally enjoy it. It's the best. It's the best.
Lovely to talk to you, Charlene. I know you got to do another interview, as we just heard. What's going on with the band? What's next with Texas?
New album comes out 28th of May, which I'm looking forward to. Still, all as always, nervous as hell, because you just never know what's going to happen. Go on tour January 2022. And at the moment, I'm just doing promo. And I don't know. I mean, they keep saying things are going to change and that we're going to go. We'll see. They keep trying to get me to go to different countries. But I keep saying, I've got my vaccine.
Are you looking forward to touring again?
Yeah. We start in Australia in January next year. So that's going to be fun.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Darlene, lovely to talk to you as always. Thank you so much for doing this today.
Cheers, love. Always a pleasure. And thank you for asking for me.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quokka. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.
When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.